بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق اجمعين، والصلاة والسلام على رسوله ونبيه وحبيبه ابي القاسم محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى
وعلى اهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Sorry to keep you standing. I should have put this thing on much earlier. I want to wish you best wishes and congratulations on the anniversary of the birth of Imam Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Jawad is very special to me. Among my African-American brothers, we call him the Black One. Why? Because his mother, Sakina, Sabika, sorry, was of the people of Nuba. And Nuba is a place in the south of Egypt, between Egypt and Sudan. And they're very tall, strapping, very, very dark people. You know, you see some pictures of Nubans, and you know, the light reflects on them and the light looks blue. They're that dark. And she was known as one of the most righteous women of her time. And she was the slave wife of Imam Ridha, alayhi salam. Who also had some African roots. Imam Ridha was also quite dark. And it is said in some of the accounts that when Imam Jawad was born, even the Arabs did not find it very difficult to accept him as an Arab. And you know, among the Arabs, there is no particular one race or one color of Arabs. How you distinguish, for example, a dark Arab from a dark African is by the texture of their hair. You know, that's why you have, for example, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam describing, for example, describing Africans, and you don't have to mention the hair. You know, hair like raisins, they might say, curly hair. That's how you would distinguish between them. Well, these Arabs thought that he was non-Arab. And they had to bring in, a physiognomist, somebody who knows how to distinguish facial features, and through the facial features was a physiognomy, that's right. You could be able to distinguish between whose father was who, and that's how they distinguish him from, and identified him with Imam Ridha, alayhi salam. The reason why I say this is because for us converts to Islam, most of us come from a Christian background. And as you all know, Christianity, although it originated in the Middle East, is now a European religion. You know, and one of the reasons why many of us have left Christianity and become Muslim is because Christianity has this kind of element of whiteness about it, a kind of exclusiveness about it. For example, Jesus is God. And when you see pictures of Jesus, Jesus is white. You look at this. So on the earth, the white man is ruling. And in heaven, the white man is also ruling. It's kind of damaging for your psychology. You find that among Muslims, you have the same type of tendency. You find, for example, among Muslims, let's say in Iran, you know, beauty is something very much associated with color. Very much. You know, you find that, you know, people tend to play down this particular aspect of the story of our imams. You find that among African people, for example, this whole idea of color also exists. You know, the lighter color the African, the more superior he feels to you. I think there is something about color and mankind. I think the lighter mankind gets, the more he thinks he's superior. You know, we say the first racist was Shaitan. And what was the excuse of Shaitan for not bowing down to Adam? He said, I am made of a smokeless fire. Smokeless fire is something brilliant. And he is made of clay, dark clay. And he looked at the surface of this, and he made an erroneous judgment. Anyway, that's not the topic of my talk today. I just want to tell you how I feel about Imam Jawad, alayhi salam. Yes, salawat to the Prophet Muhammad. Yesterday somebody called me and said, we want you to give a speech. Before they called me and said, we want to have a talk. We want to have a discussion. We want to have a debate or whatever. You know, and then they called me again and said, I want you to have a speech. So it was kind of short notice. I agreed, and I sort of racked my brain to come up with a topic. And there's a particular ayah of Quran that I find very, very useful for me, because I'm a practical type of a person. I have been very much in my life, in my youthful life, and in my present life right now, very much in the fight or the struggle for social justice and for the victory of truth. And for many of us, we tend to confront almost insurmountable social problems, and we ask ourselves, how do I solve this problem? Well, this verse says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In Allah la yughayru ma bi qawmin hatta yughayru ma bi anfusihim. Verily Allah will not change the condition of a people unless they change that which is in themselves, unless they change that which is in their very souls. Why this verse is very, very important, because as short as it is, it gives us an analysis of the causes of our social problems and its relationship to ourselves, and two, it gives us a strategy in terms of how to overcome these problems. One aspect that the verse shows us is that the subjective is necessary for changing the objective, right? Your subjective self, what is in your soul, what is in yourself. This is subjectivity. This is you as an individual, me, Ahmed Hanif, right? What is subjective, myself, I am responsible for changing my society. The society is that which is outside of myself. I might be part of it, but when I think of the society as a concept, as a reality, I objectify that society. And so it talks about the relationship between the subjective and the objective. That the general characteristics, the general problems of the society can be understood as the product of the collective individual consciousnesses of the members of that society. That all of us contribute and create and maintain the general characteristics of society. Now, when this verse is analytical in a sense, because it's talking about psychology. It's talking about our own nafs. It's talking about, when we talk about nafs, for example, the word psychology in Arabic is ilmu nafs, the knowledge of the soul. So it talks about psychology. And it is actually indicating that there is something in our psychology, something negative, because you want to change something, right? Allah will not change your condition unless you change that which is in yourself. The only thing you want to change is something negative. You never want to change something positive. So it goes without saying that it's assuming that there's something negative in the society that you want to change. And that thing that is negative in that society is reflected in you. And you cannot change that thing unless, first of all, you eradicate that thing from yourself. Now, that negative thing that we're talking about in Islam is called a nafs al-amara, the amara bisu, the nafs that commands you, right, or impels you to do evil. This is the nafs al-amara. Now, scholars would call it the animal soul. The animal soul. Now, what is this nafs al-ammara? Right? What is this animal soul? This is the soul that impels us to do things that when we look at them without a value judgment, to do things that are necessary for our survival. Right? This is an aspect of your soul that impels you to do things that are necessary, not just for your survival, but for your physical survival. So, for example, you need to eat to survive. You need to procreate to survive. This aspect of your soul tells you, go and eat. It doesn't tell you how to eat. It doesn't tell you how you go about getting your food. It tells you, go and procreate. It doesn't tell you whether you should get married or whether you should rape. That is an aspect of your soul that is instinctive. And without the control, without the governance of your act or your intelligence, without your understanding of what is right and wrong, or if that understanding of right and wrong is deficient, you could act in an immoral way upon this particular instinct or impulse. So this is what, if for example, Freud would call the id. Freud would call the id. You know, it's just the impulse, the animal impulse to move towards something. And that's what's called amara, the thing that amara, the thing that commands you, the thing that impels you to do something. And it is considered negative by virtue of the fact, only by virtue of the fact, that it, when it is divorced from a moral control. The nafs is not something bad. When we say, you know, that this person's nafs is governing them, or this person, because this person's nafs, they did so and so, that was wrong. It means the nafs that is not mutma'in, the nafs that is not firm under the governance of the intellect, under the governance of the heart. This is what it means. But your nafs is very important for your survival. If you didn't have a nafs, you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be a human being. You might be an angel, you might be worse, but you will not be a human being. This nafs is something that is very important that impels us towards growing and surviving. Give salawat to the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And it is very related to this aspect of the nafs, is related to our status as animals. A human being is an animal. A human being is a thinking animal. Why? Because an animal, you see, a tree or vegetation are things that are steady. They are rooted in the ground and they attract their nutrients to themselves. Animals don't do this. Animals feel a need and they move towards the satisfaction of that need. A lion feels hungry. Okay? It wouldn't stand on the ground and put its paws in the earth and suck something from the earth. No. You're going to go out there and hunt. Okay? He's going to smell something. An animal wants to breed, right? The female of that species that let out a scent and it moves towards that female. This is the animal instinct. And so this nafs al-amara is the animal instinct that we have, that we are talking about here. Now, in a human being, however, the difference between us and the animals is that we have a hierarchy of beings or a hierarchy of tendencies or powers. The lowest level is the level of the instinct, the level of our animal instinct. Then we get to the level of our emotions, and after that we get to the level of the intellect. The emotions are between, because your emotions actually are nothing but the mental, psychological force or drive that comes under the service of whatever tendency or whatever force in our soul is dominant. So for example, if your intellect is the one that is dominant, and your intellect says to you, injustice is wrong. Anytime you see injustice, your emotions kick in. You get upset. You get angry. You're ready to move. You're ready to overcome that injustice, right? You punch your fist in the air and you scream. You say, get me a weapon or something of that nature in order to overcome that injustice. That is the role of the emotions. The emotions only serve that force in your soul that is dominant. And if, for example, your intellect was not dominant and your nafsul ammara was dominant. In other words, for example, you thought that stealing food is sufficient for me to eat. Okay? Your emotions will back that up. Your emotions will support that. Now, there's a verse in the Holy Quran that says, and it reflects this aspect of the usefulness and also the danger of the instincts, where it says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, زُيِّنَ لِلنَّاسِ حُبُّ شَهَوَاتٍ مِنَ النِّسَاءِ وَالْبَنِينَ والقناطير المنقنطرة من الذهب والفضة والخيل المسومة والأنعام والحرث. He says, to mankind has been made to seem decorous the love of worldly desires, including women and children, accumulating piles of gold and silver, horses of mark, livestock and farms. These are the wares of the life of this world. Now, when you look at this verse, all of these things that Allah lists here, right, are important to us. Right? All of them are important to us. Okay? The love of worldly desires, our shahawat. Okay? Our desire for women, our desire for, you know, homes, our desire for security, our desire for transportation. It talks about horses of mark. Horses of mark means horses that are branded, horses that have a good breed. Today we might say the equivalent of that would be a nice car, you know. And there are hadith where the Prophet says, for example, some of the good things for the Muslim is a big house, right? A good steed, a good ride, you know, and a good wife. Okay? So it's talking about these things. And at the same time it's talking about these things, it is saying that they are dangers. Right? It's not speaking about them in a positive way. It's speaking about them in a cautionary way. Right? The love of having children, wives, accumulated piles of gold, having a savings account. You know, horses of mark, livestock and farms, property. Right? Now, Allah is talking about the love of these things. And He describes them as mata. Mata is translated as, or understood as, commodities. And commodities are things that you trade with. Commodities are things that you use in order to make your life comfortable. Okay? So he talks about this type of love. Love for these types of things. And this is what the nafs, or the nafs al-ammara, is oriented towards. Okay? Now, it is natural then for us to love these things. It does not condemn this love. But it says that they are simply the wares of the world. And with Allah is something better. Why it doesn't condemn this love is because love has different hierarchies. There's a hierarchy in love. You have, for example, the love of these types of things. The love of things that make our dunyawi life easy. The love of those things that make us survive. Because according to Allama Tabatabai, one of the ways of understanding love, one of the definitions of love, if one can say so, is that we tend to love things, or we tend to be attracted to things that complete ourselves. We tend to be attracted to those things that make us perfect. And we have a body and we have a soul. And so those things that make our bodies perfect, those things that make our survival in this world possible, we tend to love this. That's why we love food. Okay? That's why, for example, you have extremes of love of food. People might be gluttonous. That's why we love women. Okay? Or the opposite sex. You know, this is why we love freedom. This is why we love a comfort. All of these things contribute to our development. But there's only one level of love. This is a level of the physical love, of the physical perfection of ourselves. Above that, we have the love of principles. We have the love of principles. And this is now going into the area of our souls, of our spirit, the love of principles. For example, the love of justice, the love of order, the love of knowledge. Right? You know, so you'd find that it is very easy for us to sacrifice a lower love for a higher love. You may love food, but if you're in prison as a prisoner of conscience, you would easily go on a hunger strike in order to establish a principle. You may love your life, but it would be easy for you to give your life to stand up against a tyrant because the love of justice overrides the love for your own body. So we have a higher level of love called the love for principles. And above that, we have the love for truth, or the love of the truth, which is the love of Allah and for revelation and for the Prophet and so forth and so on. Give salawat to the Holy Prophet Muhammad in Islam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad in Islam. So what Allah is talking about is this love for shahawat, for the woman and for the children and for this and for that. This love is an exclusive love. This love that we put all of our energies into and none for the higher love. Now, what is society? What is society? Society basically is when people get together in order to secure their survival. We get together as society in order to secure our survival. And so society now tends to organize itself to provide for those different levels of our existence, our physical existence and our spiritual or psychological existence. This is why we get together in society. Because it recognizes that the individual on his own is not able to satisfy all of these requirements. I might be a farmer, but I'm not a doctor. I need a doctor. I need for my physical health to be looked at. I might be a doctor, but I'm not a carpenter, and I need a home. So society, we get together in order to provide for each other's needs. One of the things that society also establishes is that it establishes laws. It establishes morals. It establishes principles. Why? Because society knows that nafs al-ammara, that animal soul, those negative tendencies for our life in society is dangerous. So society tells you, okay, you want a wife? This is how you get a wife. You got to get married. And this is how you get married. And this is who you can't marry, and this is who you can marry. You want to eat? Or this is what you do. You have to work for this money, and you have to spend that money in that store, and that's how you eat, or you plant your food, but you can't steal. And every time this negative tendency of yours is acted out against society, society takes on the right of the of its members and punishes you. That's why you have laws. Now, the higher the principles, of course, because you're talking about love and the levels of love, the higher the principles of the society, the more secure the society is, the happier people are, the more developed they are. And this is why we talk about Islam as the religion that makes us happy in this life and happy in the next. Simply because, organized on the highest principles of Islam, everybody will be able to find satisfaction on all levels of their existence. At the same time, there are many societies that are deficient in some way or the other in terms of those principles. There are some societies deficient in some. For example, the society that we are living in, okay, we find that, let's say, in the area of relationship between the genders, okay, in terms of procreation, their laws, their principles are deficient. And because of this deficiency in principles, you find social crisis. And because you find social crisis, we find the manifestation of that particular thing in terms of Allah does not, change the condition of a people unless they change that which is in themselves. You find now that you are confronted with a condition that you don't like, a condition that you want to change. So you have this condition that you want to change, or you have a condition that you're suffering from. How do you solve that? Allah says, first of all, go into yourself. Why? Why? Because, for example, let's say somebody might get AIDS. Right? I got AIDS. This is a condition I hate. I want to stop that. What causes this AIDS? Is it just dropped from the sky? No. It goes back to improper sexual relations. Sexual relations without any proper control. So I might still support this uncontrolled sexual relations, but I don't like AIDS. This is where the problem, you see what the problem is? That within that soul, there still is the problem. That person, it is easily explained by, for example, taking care of the symptom and not of the cause. That person has to go inside himself. That person has to seek religious guidance in order to be able to analyze this problem. And once he perceives it in himself, what the problem is, changing that problem in himself helps to change the problem in society. Give salawat to the Holy Prophet Muhammad and his family. So whenever these needs are not met adequately by society, we have problems. When these needs are not met, we have problems. And so we have to work upon ourselves to be able to take care of it. Another aspect of this, another way of looking at it, is also in the sense of our perception of reality. Our perception of reality. All of us are sitting here right now, but every single one of us is seeing something different. Every single one of us is seeing something different. Right? There's an objective reality of myself standing here. Okay, but in every mind in this room, okay, you see something different. Not that you might see a Chinese guy standing here or something like that, no. But you interpret what you see in different ways. So, sometimes we perceive in society that we have a problem when in fact we don't. Or we perceive in society there is no problem when in fact there is. And many times, how we perceive the world makes manifest for us a particular reality. There's a very interesting statistic about, for example, battered women. Women who are subject to spousal abuse. Right? You'd find that, for example, there are some cases where there's a woman, she got into a relationship with a man. And this guy appeared to her to be a really nice guy. Bring her flowers and the whole works. And as soon as they get married, he starts beating this woman up. Alright? So they divorce, they separate. She goes and gets married to somebody else again. The first time she met this person, there's absolutely no hint of this other person being an abuser. As soon as they get into marriage, he starts to abuse her. Why? Because there's something in her soul. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying all battered women draw this to themselves. Right? But there's something in her soul that attracts a particular reality to her. I mean, for example, we have an entire industry of pop psychology right now that is making billions of dollars on this. How to be successful. Right? And how to adjust your internal perception in order to make it in life. This is a reality. So your soul is not only a cause for your success or your comfort or what have you, but it is also a cause for your problems. And not only is your soul receptive, not only does it perceive realities according to its own inner configuration, it also influences its outside reality. It also has an effect upon its environment. And it's very clear sometimes you go to a new place or a different environment and you feel what we call a vibe. We feel a different feeling. We go to some place and we say, I don't like it here. Nobody ever did you anything wrong, but I don't like it here. Why is this? It is because of those collective mentalities that have created an outward reality that is almost tangible. And this is one of the biggest problems that we Muslims face in this environment. We are concerned about our children, whether they are going to be good Muslims or not. We see some of them getting disobedient. We see the Muslims being separated, disunited. You know, we have a whole lot of problems. How do we change these problems? How do we attack these problems? We have to look on the inside. We have to ask, first of all, do I reflect this problem? We talk about unity, but we as individuals do not make any movement towards unity. We live in a society where everything is seen on the zahiri level, on the outward level, on the superficial level. We wait for somebody else to solve our problems. What Islam is saying, what the Holy Quran is saying, that somebody else is not coming. That somebody else is you. Because when you change your perspective, when you examine yourself and try to find where you are part of the problem, then you become strong. Then you become influential. Then your new thought patterns create a whirlpool in that hostile alien environment that you want to change. When you readjust your thought patterns, when you become aware of yourself, you perhaps would see a paradise in front of you when there was none at all before. You know, there's a story about Imam Jawad, alayhi salam. Where somebody came to visit him and saw the very simple and almost uncomfortable condition in which he lived and was appalled. He said, "Oh, Imam, how can you live like that?" And these Imams, you know, they had the ability to instill on people, to put on people their influence where it removed the veils of their eyes from the reality. And he did that, and this man saw that where the Imam was living was in fact a paradise. This is a dramatic example of our perspective. When we experience hardships, a lot of those hardships are actually doors or gardens in paradise. There's a hadith that says, heaven is surrounded by difficulties and hell is surrounded by ease. When we try to live according to the principles of Islam, we become more able to perceive the difference between those examinations that we are given, whether it be loss of life, loss of limb, sickness, or what have you. we are able to distinguish between those troubles that are necessary for the growth of our soul and our gateways to paradise, and those struggles or those problems that are nothing but projections of the negative aspects of our soul. One of our biggest problems as human beings is to be able to distinguish between the two. We tend to look at all of them as equal, as suffering, and we hate suffering. The only way we can distinguish between the two is through humility and worshiping Allah and trying to grow in our deen. In this way, our perception widens, and we are able to distinguish between what Allah has sent down upon us in order to purify us, and what we suffer because of the evil in our own souls. Both of them, the knowledge of both of them, are important for our growth and development. Because when we see that which is in our souls that makes us suffer, we end up waging a jihad upon that, and we improve ourselves in getting closer to Allah. I want to thank you all for bearing with me. I would like to say that whatever that I said that was true and where it was in conformity with the teachings of Islam is not from me, and I apologize for whatever errors and whatever mistakes that I would have made, because they came from my own soul. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.